Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the December 8th edition of People and the Winter 2025 edition of Real Simple. The articles that I'm sharing today include Dick Van Dyke, I Love to Laugh, How Diana Was Betrayed, and 54 Little Ways to Jumpstart 2026. Dick Van Dyke, I Love to Laugh. Merrier than ever, as he nears the century mark, the legend shares stories from his iconic career and secrets for a long, happy life. By Liz McNeil, photographs by Ari and Louise. This is a People magazine exclusive. I feel really good for 100, declares Dick Van Dyke. Sometimes I have more energy than others, but I never wake up in a bad mood. As he nears his centennial birthday on December 13th, I hope I make it, he jokes. The legendary entertainer admits to being a bit hard of hearing and a tad wobbly, using a wooden cane as he walks barefoot through his memorabilia-filled Malibu home. But the twinkly humor and lanky charm that have endeared him to generations are ever present. Between telling jokes, tinkering at the piano, and singing old favorites like Puttin' on the Ritz and Big Spender, he quips, I feel like I'm about 13. As a kid growing up during the Great Depression in Danville, Illinois, he developed a knack for pratfalls, playing cops and robbers with his brother Jerry, a skill that came in handy for the rubber-limbed star of the Dick Van Dyke Show in the early 60s. That's when Walt Disney, the man, not the company, offered him the role of a lifetime as Bert the Chimney Sweep in the 1964 classic Mary Poppins, opposite an incandescent Julie Andrews. A turn in 1968's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang cemented his status as a national treasure. How rare it is that a person gets to do what they love, he reflects, sitting next to his wife of 13 years, Arlene Silver, 54. I look forward to getting up every morning because it's what I would have done for nothing. In a new book, 100 Rules for Living to 100, he shares his eternal optimism, why he doesn't fear death, when you expire, and how he hopes to be remembered. For as long as children are proudly belting out their new word, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, or singing and skipping along to Chim Chim Cheree, the most important part of me will always be alive. How are you feeling? I have no pain, no discomfort. Short-term memory problems, it's true. I can't remember what I had for breakfast. So I have my wife here, who is in possession of my memory bank. But my long-term memory's pretty good. And how's your health? I have kidney problems, a bad left leg, but lately I've been doing some walking. They say that cuts down the chance of Alzheimer's. You have to do 5,000 steps a day, which is a little further than I intended. But I'll be up and around. I could dance if this leg was working. What surprised you most about this age? The fact that I made it. People say, what did you do right? I don't know. I'm rather lazy. I've always thought that anger is one thing that eats up a person's insides, and hate. And I never really was able to work up a feeling of hate. I think that is one of the chief things that kept me going. My father was a person who was constantly upset by the state of things in his life, and it did take him at 73 years old. Lauren Van Dyke, who had emphysema, died in 1975. You've said, the end of my life is so much closer. How does that feel? I don't have any fear of death for some reason. I can't explain that, but I don't. I've had such a wonderfully full and exciting life that I can't complain. Did you ever think you would retire? I'd be working now if I could get a job. I see Ted Danson. He's got a series, Netflix's A Man on the Inside. He's an old buddy. I said, you gotta get me a series. How do you celebrate on December 13th? My wife is planning a citywide Malibu celebration. It's kind of interesting because in 1948, I got married to first wife Margie Willett and took a little two-bedroom apartment on the beach here and couldn't pay the rent. I came home one night and all my belongings were out on the highway. I got thrown out. So this is kind of my revenge. How much was the rent? It was more than I had. Then you made magic with Mary Tyler Moore on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Creator Carl Reiner was casting, and it was between me and Johnny Carson. Fortunately, Johnny and I ended up where we belonged. Carl must have interviewed 100 girls. The thing about Mary, from the first word, she was perfect. Your therapist later said you had a crush on her. We had a crush on each other. Purely innocent, but we just loved each other. She was quite a gal. What are your favorite memories of making Mary Poppins? The little guy, Matthew Garber, who played Michael Banks, oftentimes, we'd have to stand there while they lit, and he would get bored and bite me on the butt, just playing. The little girl, Karen Dotrys, was sweet. And of course, Julie was the lady of all time. I don't think we ever had an argument. We just had a good time. She got the Oscar in 1965 for Best Actress. So the crew made me a statue. It's a little man with a broom made out of nuts and bolts, and it's sprayed gold. What's your favorite song from the film? The first number of When We Go Into the Fantasy. Ain't it a beautiful day? He sings. Right as a morning in May, I feel like I could fly. Have you stayed in touch with Julie? I haven't seen her in years. I sure would like to see her. How did you learn the choreography? I was not a dancer. I never trained or anything. I didn't know I could do what I did. Then, in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, in Me Old Bamboo, we had to jump over that bamboo, and every time, one guy would miss. We did 26 takes. That last shot is the last one I could have done. The choreographer kept saying, you can do it. They knew how I moved, unorthodox to say the least. What was your toughest time? Well, I probably neglected my family. When we first got married, we had nothing. No money, no car, no anything. So I spent most of my time working to get out of poverty. I'm regretful that I was on the road and not being with the kids as much as I should have. I was doing a disc jockey show at 5 a.m. and working in nightclubs, getting 3 or 4 hours of sleep in between. I made up for it later. My kids are in their 70s now. My son's an old man. Barry, now 74, worked with me the whole 10 years on TV series Diagnosis Murder. I gave jobs to everybody, even my grandkids. How many grandkids do you have now? I don't know, turns to Arlene. How many are there? 8, she tells him. Oh, yeah, my grandkids I know, but my great-grandkids I don't. They're sprouting everywhere. How did you know Arlene was the one? I was backstage at the 2006 SAG Awards, waiting to go on, and one thing I had never done was ever approach a strange woman in my life. She walked by, and without thinking, I jumped up and said, "Hi, I'm Dick," and found out she was a makeup lady, and I hired her on the spot. I kept proposing, and I finally won out. She sings and dances. There's some fate in there. How did you handle the age difference? Well, it hasn't turned out to be any problem. I'm infantile to start with. Emotionally, I'm about 13. And she's quite mature for her age. She is responsible for keeping me in the moment and alive every day. Thank God for that. How do you want to be remembered? What I've left in the way of children's entertainment and children's music, that's my legacy. I don't think remembering me is that important, but it's the music we leave behind. That's what I'm most proud of. My favorite is U2 from Chitty. Someone to care for, to be there for. How do you stay so hopeful? I just think I was born with a brighter outlook. I think some people are born just to have to fight against a downward spiral. I look at the horizon, and after 100 years, I think I'm right. What do you hope to hear at the Pearly Gates? Come on in. I hope I make it to the Pearly Gates and not the other one. I've been a good boy. What do you think it is about you that made people respond with such love? I've always been honest. I'll sometimes lie to save somebody's feelings, maybe. Other than that, I don't know. I got elected to junior class president in high school, and I wasn't even on the ballot. I was the class clown, so maybe that's why I made people laugh. Coldplay collab. He starred in Malibu neighbor Chris Martin's 2024 All My Love video. He has such humor and goodness and charisma and charm and playfulness and a beautiful voice and way of moving, says Martin. And then under that, deep sincerity and authenticity. It feels like those lighter qualities are maybe his choices in the face of life's challenge and suffering. He actually has 2 incredible voices, both singing and speaking, which feels a bit unfair on the rest of us. So really, he's a superhuman. The Dick Van Dyke Show, 1961 to 1966. It was meant to be, he says, of his chemistry with Mary Tyler Moore. Mary Poppins, 1964. God, it was fun, he recalls, of making magic with Julie Andrews, child actors Karen Dotrice and Matthew Garber, and dancing penguins. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, 1968. You couldn't get going very fast, but it was fun to drive, says Van Dyke. Mary Poppins Returns, 2018. I got to dance at 92. I grew into the part. Love Knows No Age. Step in Time. She's also a good belly dancer, says Van Dyke about Arlene and their 2012 wedding. We just made it work, says Van Dyke's wife, Arlene Silver, of their 46-year age difference. This house, we made it our own little world here, and age doesn't matter. She calls her husband the best human being I've ever met, and he credits her for keeping him young at heart. She's responsible for keeping me in the moment, says Van Dyke. It's hard to believe. It's chance I picked her out of a crowd. There's some fate in there. She can get me singing or dancing. She took the time and trouble to learn all my favorite songs, music from the 40s and on. Cheers to Dad at the 2021 Kennedy Center Honors with two of his four kids, Carrie Beth, 64, and Chris, 75. Another son, Barry, is 74. His oldest daughter, Stacy, died by suicide in 2017. You've been listening to a People Magazine exclusive. Dick Van Dyke, I Love to Laugh. Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen, We Don't Take Anything for Granted. From an unexpected spark on a movie set to 30 years of marriage, the couple, now starring together on the hit series A Man on the Inside, continues to be each other's biggest fans, by Julie Jordan from People Magazine. Every morning, Ted Danson brings his wife, actress Mary Steenburgen, a cup of coffee. I can't ever be mad at him for anything, because that one act is the best thing in the world, she says. Danson, 77, insists, It's me at my most manly, to be honest. I forage for coffee. The next few hours entail taking their beloved dog Blue for a walk and playing Wordle, Connections, and Spelling Bee. We're bright enough to do these games together, allows Steenburgen, 72, so we each have half of a really amazing brain. Most recently, the duo added another item on their daily to-do list. Star together as love interests in the second season of Danson's hit Netflix comedy, A Man on the Inside. Married since October 1995, the two began dating after first co-starring in the 1994 film Pontiac Moon. Danson had just split from Whoopi Goldberg and finalized his divorce from his second wife, Casey Coates, with whom he shares daughters Kate and Katrina. Steenburgen was raising her kids, Charlie and Lily, after ending her marriage to actor Malcolm McDowell. 3 decades later, the two are more grateful than ever to have found each other. I would never have imagined that I would be madly in love and have fun and laugh in my late 70s, says Danson. Add Steenburgen, for two people who in some ways are quite different, we are weirdly compatible. Congratulations on your 30th anniversary. Did you do anything fun to celebrate? Ted Danson, I had to work. But then, the next day, we got on a plane and flew to Japan, just the two of us. Mary Steenburgen, we've never been there, and it was number one on our wish list for travel. We really loved it. The whole experience blew our minds. We last spoke after your 25th for People's Love Issue. How has your relationship evolved since? Danson, we have 2 new grandchildren in our life, so the things that delight us and we're blessed by just keep growing. Steenburgen, we now have 5 grandchildren and we're pretty obsessed with them. Danson, and we're still getting to work and we still have fun together. Life is good. So what made you want to act together again now? Steenburgen, I listened to Ted come home through The Good Place and then the first season of this show, just delighting in the extraordinary scripts and a cast and crew that he's so proud to work with. And I was always a little envious. So to be asked to be a part of this was so thrilling. I felt so honored and lucky every single day. Danson, I heard about her being asked to join maybe moments before Mary did, and they asked me how I felt, and it was really a dream come true. We both love being actors. We both love the process. So we spent 2.5 months together getting up, going to work early, but just giggling the whole time because of what we got to say and do. It was just really a great opportunity. That is a lot of together time. Did you ever need a break from each other? Steenburgen, no. We even shared a trailer. And we also had our dog there, which was lovely. We don't get bored with each other. I don't know what that says, but I still feel like we have a whole lot of stuff I want to talk to him about. Danson, we found each other later in life, so I had ironed out a fair amount of my stuff that didn't work and created problems in other relationships. I finally matured emotionally by the time I met Mary. We don't take anything for granted, especially at this age. On that note, what do you love most about your relationship? Steenburgen. He knows the most petty, small, ugly parts of me. And he knows the highest, soulful, aspirational parts, and somehow loves the whole thing. And I've been extremely honest with him. That was important to me. We both feel that. Danson, the only time we fight or get angry with each other is when I'm wrong. Because she'll point something out that disappointed or angered her or hurt her feelings, and I just refuse to be that person. So I argue and resist until I finally go, yeah, yeah, that's me. What's your favorite thing to do together? Danson whispers, Wordle. Steenburgen, no, I think it's... Danson, family, kids, dinner. Steenburgen, yeah, kids and our dog, singing stupid songs about our dog. Danson, speaking in his voice. Steenburgen, saying what he's thinking about the other person. But at the end of the day, our favorite people to hang out with are our kids. We find them hilarious and fun and interesting people. It's just a really beautiful family with a lot of funny, wonderful babies and kids. Is there anything left on your bucket list? Danson, we haven't really been on a safari-like thing. There's so many places I would love to see. But I don't have any like, oh, if I only could play this part or go there. I am so content and grateful right now. I don't mean it's always easy. Steenburgen, intention has become a part of my life with people I love. With not wasting time on people that aren't in my life for the right reason. For being honest with myself about life. All that stuff, aging, it actually makes it more interesting. What's your secret for a successful marriage? Danson, well, I'm madly in love with her. I really admire her. Steenburgen, I'd say it's the laughter. It's pretty hard to resist, and it diffuses everything. Even when he's wrong? Steenburgen, even then. Danson, which means she's laughing nonstop. A duo over the decades. Pontiac Moon. Both admit they weren't looking for romance after starring together in the 1994 film. Ink. Danson played a newspaper columnist to Steenburgen's managing editor in the 1996 to 1997 sitcom. Gulliver's Travels. The couple starred as husband and wife in the 1996 miniseries. Mr. Mayor. Steenburgen guest starred as a girlfriend of Danson's character on his NBC series in 2022. You've been listening to Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen, We Don't Take Anything for Granted, from People Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. How Diana Was Betrayed. 30 years later, new revelations expose how a journalist's lies and a BBC cover-up drew Princess Diana into her most famous interview, An Altered Royal History, by Simon Perry and Aaron Hill. This is a People Magazine exclusive. Before the cameras captured the line that would echo through history, there were three of us in this marriage. Princess Diana stood in her private sitting room at Kensington Palace on November 5th, 1995, watching three men she had quietly ushered inside unpack camera equipment smuggled in cardboard boxes. She had sent her staff home. No makeup artist, no stylist, no standard TV crew. This interview for the BBC investigative program, Panorama, had to be in secret. The stakes, she believed, were that high. Decades later, it became clear that the interview was the product of an extraordinary deception. A 2021 independent inquiry led by then UK senior judge Lord Dyson, found that journalist Martin Bashir had used forged documents to manipulate Diana, a scheme BBC executives later tried to conceal. Prince William would go on to blame the interview for fueling his mother's fear, paranoia, and isolation, and worsening her strained relationship with Prince Charles. Investigative journalist Andy Webb has spent nearly 20 years unearthing the full truth, first sparking media coverage and ultimately prompting the Dyson inquiry, which he says overlooked the BBC's 25-year cover-up. As recently as 2024, his freedom of information battle forced the release of thousands of additional BBC emails, though many remain heavily redacted. Webb's new book, Diana Rama, Deception, Entrapment, Cover-Up, The Betrayal of Princess Diana, lays bare for the first time the full scope of Bashir's manipulation, luring Diana's brother, Charles Spencer, himself a victim of Bashir's tactics, to gain access to the princess, presenting forged bank statements suggesting palace staff were spying on her, and spreading false claims that Princess Charles wanted to have her killed and that William's watch was a spying device. Her life became untethered, Webb tells People. It was frenzied between the interview and her death. Diana had reason to trust Bashir. He worked for one of the world's most respected news organizations. Already wary of palace officials and shaken by breaches of her privacy, including Squidgygate, a secretly recorded phone call that went public in 1992, she felt watched and increasingly isolated. her former private secretary, Patrick Jeffson, says that Bashir picked a very opportune moment to show the faked bank statements to Spencer and convince him that people in Diana's orbit, including Jeffson and a senior aide to Prince Charles, were accepting money to spy on her. She was in a state of justified anxiety, says Jeffson. It is not paranoia if you have reasonable grounds to believe that they are out to get you, adds close friend Rosa Monckton. She was frail, and that made her susceptible. After Spencer, 61, arranged a meeting with Diana, Webb alleges, Bashir falsely told her that her son's nanny, Tiggy Leg Bork, was having an affair with Charles, producing a forged document suggesting she had undergone an abortion paid for by the prince. Those claims were said to be the final catalyst that drove Diana to do the interview. By the time the interview arrived, just weeks after that first meeting, Bashir's influence was firmly in place. Diana insisted on a stripped-down crew. Bashir, a producer and a cameraman, who slipped into the palace under the cover story of demonstrating a sound system. Webb describes Diana and Bashir spending 90 minutes in the kitchen, reviewing the questions and rehearsing for what would become one of the most consequential broadcasts in royal history. When the interview aired on November 20th, 1995, it delivered bombshell after bombshell. Diana spoke openly about Charles's relationship with Camilla Parker Bowles and her struggle with bulimia, and confirmed her own affair with James Hewitt. It was a performance. The smoothness, the facility, the fluidity. At no point did Diana appear flustered, Webb says. The now iconic image of her eyeliner-rimmed stare drew an estimated 200 million global viewers, none aware of the lies behind it. The fallout was immediate. Within a month, Queen Elizabeth ordered Charles and Diana to proceed with a divorce, a step Jeffson says wouldn't have been inevitable without the interview. It was not unreasonable to hope that before Panorama, there could still be a royal reconciliation. Jeffson resigned in January 1996, unaware of why the princess had turned sharply against him. It is chilling to rerun those events, he says, and feel that Diana was seeing me as the enemy within. Meanwhile, BBC executives knew something was wrong. In late 1995, a graphic designer told higher-ups that the bank statements were fake. When challenged, Bashir admitted to forgery, but lied to managers, insisting he hadn't shown them to anyone. Only when it became impossible to hide did he confess to showing the forgeries to Spencer. Instead of confronting the implications, the BBC launched a 1996 internal review, later condemned as woefully ineffective. It accepted Bashir's shifting explanations, cleared him of wrongdoing, and buried facts that wouldn't emerge for decades. BBC bosses knew enough to warn Diana that she had been dealing with a fraudster, says Webb. Her life would have followed a different path if she had been warned. She might plausibly still be alive today, a grandmother at 64, enjoying her 5 grandchildren. The consequences were lethal. For their part, The outlet tells people, the BBC appointed Lord Dyson to investigate how Martin Bashir obtained the 1995 Panorama interview with Diana, Princess of Wales. The Dyson report was published in 2021. The BBC accepted its findings in full and publicly apologized for its part in the report's conclusion. It's not enough for her brother. High-ranking people in the BBC participated in securing this interview through appalling deception, says Spencer, who has supported Webb's investigation. I am sure that this led directly to Diana being left vulnerable in Paris on the night she died. By the time of that final trip in August 1997, Diana had lost the guidance of her loyal aide. Distrusting palace officials, she had long declined official protection and relied instead on the security provided by then-boyfriend Dodi Fayed's team, a setup that proved fatally insufficient. Without adequate counsel and protection, Diana was vulnerable in Paris, where she died at age 36 in a high-speed crash caused by her driver's intoxication and reckless driving amid a chase by paparazzi. Because Diana had been tricked into distrusting every kind of official protection, says Jeffson, she put herself in a position where she had to accept the protection of people who were not competent. Diana died unaware of Bashir's machinations. Yet she was troubled by the pain the interview had caused her sons. 10 days before her death, she told Monckton on vacation in Greece that she regretted the interview because of the harm she thought it had done to her boys, Monckton recalls. The impact continues to reverberate. In 2021, Prince Harry, 41, stated, "Our mother lost her life because of this." Prince William, 43, who Webb says has a copy of his book, echoed that anguish. "What saddens me most is that if the BBC had properly investigated the complaints and concerns first raised in 1995, my mother would have known that she had been deceived. She was failed not just by a rogue reporter, but by the leaders at the BBC who looked the other way rather than asking the tough questions. These failings not only let my mother down and my family down, they let the public down too." Panorama to Paris. Key moments that led from deception to tragedy. August 31, 1995. Martin Bashir shows Charles Spencer forged documents to gain access to Diana. September 14, 1995. A second set of forged documents is shown to Spencer. He calls Diana, who wants to know more. September 19, 1995, Bashir meets Diana and Spencer at a London apartment and uses false claims to gain her trust. October 28, 29, 1995, Diana is shown forged document alleging Tiggy Leg Bork had an abortion paid for by Charles. November 5, 1995. Diana secretly films the Panorama interview in a sitting room at Kensington Palace. November 20, 1995. BBC airs the 54-minute Panorama special, an interview with HRH, the Princess of Wales. December 20, 1995. Queen Elizabeth sends letters to Charles and Diana stating that an early divorce is desirable. December 21, 1995. Bashir denies showing forged documents to Spencer when questioned by BBC executives. March 23, 1996. Bashir admits showing forged documents to Spencer. BBC cover-up begins. August 31, 1997. Diana dies following a car crash in Paris without the trusted security she once relied on in public life. Who's who in the Panorama saga? Martin Bashir resigned from the BBC in May 2021, 6 days before the Dyson inquiry was released, citing health problems. Charles Spencer told Webb, "It still rankles with me hugely that there's been such a sustained and pointless cover-up." Patrick Jeffson was Diana's private secretary for nearly 8 years and donated his $122,000 BBC settlement to one of her causes. Tiggy Leg Bork won damages from the BBC in 2022. The distress caused to the royal family is a source of great upset to me, says the former nanny. Diana's Panorama bombshells. Charles and Camilla. Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded. Her affair with James Hewitt. Yes, I was in love with him, but I was very let down. Her eating disorder. Rampant bulimia. It was a symptom of what was going on in my marriage. Self-harm. I did inflict upon myself. I didn't like myself. I was ashamed because I couldn't cope with the pressures. Charles as king. It would bring enormous limitations to him, and I don't know whether he could adapt to that. You've been listening to a People magazine exclusive, How Diana Was Betrayed. Tidy up your medicine cabinet. Here's your prescription to get all those toiletries in order, by Hannah Baker from Real Simple magazine. Move the meds. The rapid temp changes, plus all that shower steam, can affect the potency of your pills. Get them out of this poorly named cabinet and store them in a cool, dry place, out of reach of kids and pets. Clean house. Oils, creams, lotions, and potions can leak, so pull everything out and wipe down the bottles and shelves. Then toss stuff you never use or anything that's expired. This way you can start fresh. Add more storage. No offense to the skinny shelves inside, but they're not enough. Stick containers on the inside of the door, add jars for bits and bobs, and slide in tiny risers to maximize every inch of vertical space. Do a regroup. Store like with like. If you want to take things a step further, line up your daily essentials in the order you use them, from AM to PM. Tomorrow, when you're groggy, you can just go down the line. This has been Tidy Up Your Medicine Cabinet from Real Simple. 54 Little Ways to Jumpstart 2026. Kick off the new year on the right foot, by Melissa Matthews. Illustrations by Monica Garwood, from Real Simple magazine. Before we begin, this is not your typical New Year, New You resolution story, because you're pretty great as you are. And those stories can be stressful. Instead, it's a different kind of resolution story, one that has tiny, realistic action items, impactful things you can do to have more fun, feel happier and calmer, and put things in your favor. Make a point to do as many things on this list as possible, and 2026 won't know what hit it. Watch an old movie you love. A few suggestions for you: Drop Dead Fred, 16 Candles, Dirty Dancing, Heathers, Raising Arizona, or whatever you want. Create a playlist that's exclusively for the shower or the bath. Write a thank you note. They're not just for gifts. Thank a friend who met you for a walk and listened to you rant about your silly teenagers. Thank your mail carrier for bringing packages all the way up to your porch. Thank your regular barista for remembering you like your coffee with exactly 1.58 scoops of sugar. You get the idea. Try a recipe that you saved ages ago. Even if it's not a winner, you'll have at least tried something new. Gaze at some greenery for a little boost. During a recent study published in the journal People and Nature, a group of 117 people wore eye-tracking glasses that measured where they looked while on walks. The participants reported feeling more restored and less anxious when they looked at natural spaces and plants versus urban elements like streets and buildings. Give a stranger a compliment. Hold the door for a different stranger. Pet a dog. Note, if it's not yours, ask the paw rent for permission first. Take 10 minutes to tidy up. Pick one room or area, like the den or your clothes chair. Every primary bedroom in America has one. Set a timer. Ready? Go. You will be tackling a mess, and research finds that sprucing up can help you perk up. According to data from the American Cleaning Institute, 66% of 1,000 people surveyed said a clean home enhanced their mood, while 60% said it decreased stress and anxiety. Spend the day in your PJs. If you don't have any plans, a weekend day is a great option for this one. Have a $0 day. Spend absolutely no money at all. Make some soup. Be careful while eating soup. No burnt tongues. Host a happy hour at home. Pick up your favorite bottle of wine, or if you have time, find a fancy cocktail or mocktail to make. Get some sunshine on a morning stroll. Soaking up a moderate amount of rays with sunscreen helps you feel awake, boosts your vitamin D levels, important for bone health, and can be good for your mental health. Donate to charity. Give some money or time. There's loads of research that links these altruistic behaviors with higher levels of happiness. Yay! Sing in the car. Carpool karaoke, anyone? Aside from being fun, there's some science suggesting that belting out those lyrics can really pay off. A 2025 paper published in Brain Sciences reviewed studies analyzing research in people over the age of 60 and found that singing can help improve our ability to remember things. Mend a tear, sew on a button, or fix a zipper. The calm of repeated action, the quiet brain time, the great sense of being self-sufficient. Eat cheese for dinner. Put some on a pretty plate along with a pile of crackers, fruit, and nuts for a fairly well-rounded meal. Eat a cookie while happily standing over the sink. Dial up an old friend. If an out-of-the-blue call feels intimidating, send a thinking of you text to get the conversation going. Read a poem. Emily Dickinson's How Happy is the Little Stone is a good one. Explore your city. Science shows benefits to wandering. A 2020 study published in Nature Neuroscience found that people reported being happier on days when they had greater roaming entropy, meaning they visited more places. Let's go. Play a board game. Frame some of your favorite memories. Go through your camera roll and pick a few of your photos from the past year. Print them using an online service like Printeak or Nation's Photo Lab. Open your windows. The air quality inside our homes can be worse than the air quality outside. Yes, it's cold, but do it anyway for a bit. Delete a ton of emails, at least 100. Put something you've already done on your to-do list, then cross it off. You did it. Take a box breathing break. To do it, breathe out slowly, releasing all the air from your lungs. Then breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, and finally pause for 4 seconds while holding the exhale before repeating all the steps. Do this until you feel calm, which can take 3 to 5 minutes. Wear a sweater in your favorite color. Although there are studies examining the mood-altering effects of specific colors, research finds that perception can be subjective, so it's important to wear colors that have positive associations for you. Plan a vacation. Even if it's just a long weekend somewhere nearby, research shows we feel better when there is something to look forward to. Add more blankets to your sofa. Reorganize your scariest closet. Designate no tech time with your loved ones. Cook dinner, play cards, tell stories, and just hang out. Sign up for a class. It can be virtual or in real life. It can be about anything, such as personal finance, gardening, or a different cooking technique. The point is just to learn something new. Opt for table lamps as often as possible, and turn off the big light, that harsh overhead one. Wipe down your baseboards. Your whole space will instantly look a million times better. Pick up errant trash the next time you see some. Steam clean your sofa. Rent a machine from your local home improvement store. Give your inner critic a name and tell that jerk to go kick rocks. Spritz on your nicest perfume. Put it on your inner wrist and take a whiff now and then. Not going anywhere? So what? You'll smell nice just for you. Ask a friend to recommend a book and read it. If it's in your budget, throw something extra into your cart at the grocery store. You might find a new favorite snack. Or, if you can, spring for the luxe version of something on your list. For example, the fresh bakery sourdough over the packaged bread on the shelf. Add citrus slices to your water. You know how nice it is when you go out to eat and your water comes with the lemon wedge? Treat yourself to that little upgrade at home. Test your balance. Stand on one leg for a minute, and then, holding the position, try to put a shoe on the other foot. Watch the sunrise. Watch the sunset. Can happen on 2 different days. Talk to your dishes while you give them a bath. Sorry, we mean wash them. Hold a plank for as long as you can. Experts will tell you that resistance training is just as important as cardio. Go get the mail while wearing a funny hat. Give yourself permission to scroll for 15 minutes. Watch YouTube videos, send memes, heart your friends' posts. But do it all mindfully, so pay attention to the content and truly enjoy it. Have a solo dance party in the kitchen. Don't worry, no one is watching. Eat the chocolate. Buy the fantastic smelling candle. Start a gratitude journal. While lots of research finds these can lead to improvements in general well-being, there's one new study from Current Oncology that's especially interesting. When breast cancer patients kept a gratitude journal for 3 weeks, they showed greater resilience and improved quality of life compared to patients who didn't. Give it a try. This has been 54 Little Ways to Jumpstart 2026 from Real Simple Magazine. Thanks for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the fun stories in our program today and make plans to join us again next week for another entertaining collection of women's magazine articles. And don't forget, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream or access shows on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona apps for Apple and Android. Have a great day and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.